far as we can see, we're not taking any bets, just playing the house. Slashing the tires on the restrictive ride that keeps us in the lane between the lanes. And we just never slow down. It doesn't even hurt when we hit the ground. We don't slow down for anyone who says it's so hard when you get old. We don't shop and taking chances, we double our romances. Got plenty of time for everyone. Sometimes we share, sometimes we're not there. Love is a drug for the young Americans. And we just never slow down. It doesn't even hurt when we hit the ground. We don't put on the brakes for anyone who says, oh, it's so hard when you get old. Just never slow down. It doesn't even hurt when we hit the ground. We don't slow down for anyone who says it's so hard when you.
RCT Pittsburgh. Automation is the key. I am Dr. Jazz, PhD.
All right, let's start today with a sort of comprehensive COVID update. You know, last week I told you that COVID cases were down in the United States on average about 20% per day from their Delta peak. And we laid out a few possibilities as to why the numbers look that way. So to remind you, the things we talked about last week were vaccination is responsible, more vaccination, fewer cases. Okay. Some natural seasonality being responsible, even though it's not exactly lining up with the typical flu season, that there seems to be some kind of peaks and valleys seasonality to COVID. So many infections have gotten us closer to herd immunity combined with vaccination. That has been suggested. And then also sort of the most nefarious explanation is cases aren't actually going down. Its reporting has become less reliable. Some states maybe aren't even being honest about cases. And then at the end of last week's segment, we said, well, let's wait and see if this trend continues. The trend has continued. And in the last week, the numbers have dropped even more. U.S. cases per day are down now 31% relative to the Delta peak. The Delta peak was about 166,000 cases per day. We're now down to 114,000 cases per day. Now, this is still like a wild, crazy number, but a 31% decline is notable for sure. Now, last week, we didn't know whether deaths were declining. And what I mean by that is that deaths tend to lag cases by 3 to 4 weeks. And since last week, we were about 3 weeks into the case decline, we saw deaths level out, but we just didn't know, are deaths really starting down? Are they on the way down? We now have another week of data, and we can see that yes, deaths are declining in the United States, down about 11% on average from the Delta peak. It's not that much, but it is now clearly the direction. The Delta peak was about 1,850 cases per day, roughly half of the 3,900 cases, deaths per day that we saw at the biggest peak of the pandemic so far. So Delta peak deaths peaked at 1,850. Down to 1650, still a horrifying, unconscionable amount of death, basically half of a 9/11 every single day. But you'd rather see the numbers going down rather than up. Now, one other thing that we should be looking at is whether what's going on in the United States seems to follow or track what's happening globally. If cases were going down in the U.S. but up everywhere, we might say, well, maybe our reporting's wrong, or maybe something just doesn't make sense, because we saw, you know, Delta came to Europe and then it came to the U.S. and things seem to sort of move in tandem, adjusting for vaccination rates, of course. The U.S. Delta wave down 31% from its peak. Globally, cases are also down about the same, about 30% decline in cases globally. And then very important as well, global deaths since the peak of Delta also declining by about 25%, which you really like to see. Now, within the United States, we have clearer and clearer data about the political alignment of this Delta wave. We've talked about this before, and we continue to get very interesting new data. Check out this incredible graphic, which I will describe if you're not watching today. This is a plot of COVID deaths per capita against how pro-Trump or pro-Biden a state was in 2020. So if a state voted Biden over Trump by 20 points, it's more pro-Biden than if Biden won by, say, 10 points. Okay, now, if you're looking at this graph, you can see that the states with the lowest per capita death rates as of September 23rd's 14-day average, so we're talking now in September, you see that it's the heavy Biden states with the lowest death rate. Vermont, Massachusetts, Maryland, California, to a lesser degree, you know, places that are slightly pro-Biden, like Illinois, Nevada, where Biden won, but not by as much. The slightly Trump states are then doing even worse in terms of COVID deaths. So like Texas, for example, Florida, and then you get into the absolute worst states with the highest average per capita death rates in September. These are the heaviest Trump states. We're talking about Alabama, West Virginia, Mississippi, et cetera. So as we've said before, as we've seen before in the data, we don't just say it, we say it if we see it in the data, Trump voting in 2020 predicts COVID death rates now that vaccines have been widely available for some time and that we know how you reduce the amount of spread. This is not really a mystery. And when you look at the United States and look at the least vaccinated states, it's essentially all red states. It's Idaho, West Virginia, Wyoming, followed by Mississippi, North Dakota, Alabama, Tennessee, Indiana, Louisiana. You then get to Ohio, which is sort of, you know, closer to 50-50. Ohio, a swing state in many elections, at 54% vaccination. I think you get the picture. So the overall story here is cases and deaths declining in the U.S., cases and deaths declining globally, vaccination going up globally, and in the U.S., the states that are doing the best are the most vaccinated states, which are Biden states. There's really no new information in that sense, but this is the trend as of the last few weeks in the United States. So let's hope it continues. Let's hope it gets better everywhere, and we'll report back in another week or so and see if the decline continues. If this decline were to continue, in 6 weeks, we would be in amazingly great shape. Caveat, I said the exact same thing in February, where we said, if these declines continued, there would be no COVID in like 6 weeks. That's rarely the way that it goes. So we'll continue to track the numbers and see where we end up. Is it good that many of the most powerful federal elected officials in the United States are in their 80s or even close to their 90s in some cases? Now, let me set this up for you. Last week, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley announced he's going to be running for re-election. He is 88. Senate terms are 6 years long. We're talking 90s if he wins. Joe Biden is almost 79. Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, is 81. Steny Hoyer is 82. Jim Clyburn is 81. Those are the top three Democrats in the House of Representatives. Over in the Senate, the Democratic leader Chuck Schumer is only 70. Republican leader Mitch McConnell, 79 years old. Senator Dianne Feinstein, 88 years old. Bernie is 80 years old. Patrick Leahy's 81. Jim Inhofe is 86. I can give you the list. Fine. This is not about ageism. Republicans have actually been using ageist tropes against Joe Biden. Joe Biden's barely older than Donald Trump, their big alpha boy, strong hero. Joe Biden's barely older. Republicans have been using a lot of ageist tropes against Joe Biden. I have no interest in like just a generally ageist discussion. It's more about, is this country well represented if our elected officials skew so dramatically older than the average population? Now, to some degree, it makes sense. 5-year-olds contribute to the average population, But five-year-olds can't be senators. So, like, to some degree, it would make sense that our elected officials are older than the average population, but we're talking about dramatically so. We've also talked before about whether there should be an upper age limit for president, for example. This isn't about, you know, imposing anything. Some people want an upper age limit. This is more about whether it could be argued that the population of the United States overall is well served and well represented by folks who skew dramatically older. There's a strong case to be made that the answer is no. Now, at the same time, we want people who are more experienced. Oftentimes, people get good at their jobs after they've been in the job for a while. You can also have corruption and rot, which sets in when people have been in their jobs for a while. We want people who know how these legislative bodies work and know how to get things done. And if you increase turnover dramatically in the House and Senate, you probably increase this revolving door of lobbyists and a number of other problems. Now, aside from an age limit, you can also look at term limits, but there's quite a bit of literature in terms of term limits, which says term limits create corruption and they create incompetence because you force out lots of people who could be doing their job really well. They force people out as they become more experienced, and you create the opportunity for moneyed interests to interfere and swoop in, write legislation. It's a complicated issue for sure. The idea of an age limit is not unheard of. Many people don't know that Canada has a maximum age for senators. There's mandatory retirement for Canadian senators at age 75. So then we get at the end to turnout is really low in the United States. Without changing anything about the rules, term limits, maximum age, or any of this stuff, if more people wanted younger elected officials, they could get out and vote for them, support them in primaries, and the problem would sort of take care of itself. Now, many people would say, hey, there's too many 80-year-olds and my generation's not represented, and I'm going to go out and vote. But a lot of the people who say that don't actually go out and vote. Does that make sense? No, but it's the situation that we have. So do we really need age limits? Do we really need term limits? Or do we just need more voter participation and higher turnout from younger people who are overwhelmingly underrepresented in the electorate that chooses to vote? It would make sense, like if you step back from all of this, if older folks are more reliable voters, it makes sense that you might see older folks also overrepresented in terms of who wins. So let me know your thoughts. Is this really an issue that elected representatives, particularly in the Senate and in general in federal government, skew older? And if it is a problem, are we better off leaning on a solution like a term limit or an age limit? Or is this really just an issue of apathy among those who casually would like younger representatives, but aren't actually going out and voting in significant numbers? Let me know your thoughts. Is it a problem and what is the solution if so? You can find me on Twitter at dpacman. Remember that the David Pakman Show does depend on viewers like you, listeners like you, who sign up on our website and become members. We do an extra show every day for our members, and you can sign up at joinpakman.com. Let's get right into some vaccination-related controversies. More and more, the question is coming up, is it time to fire unvaccinated employees? Is it just time to say, listen, all of this stuff about if it's over 100 employees, then you can test weekly, although some places like Fox News are even stricter and they're saying, well, no, you've actually got to test daily. Is it just time to end all of it? And I want to look at a couple of articles with you. Interesting article in Salon by Amanda Marcotte called "It's Time to Start Firing Unvaccinated People. Trump fans are overdue for a lesson in consequences. The absolute certainty of losing a job is going to motivate a lot more people than the more abstract risk of dying." For those readers who only peruse headlines, the impending first round of vaccine mandate deadlines are looking like very scary business. Not for people who are afraid of needles, mind you, but those who are afraid that mass resignations and firings and subsequent staffing shortages of essential workers are coming. These healthcare workers would rather get fired than get vaccinated, reads a Monday morning headline at the New York Times. New York hospitals face possible mass firings as workers spurn vaccines, is another headline. Rural hospitals worry they will lose staff because of Biden's new vaccine mandate, warns an NPR headline. New York may use the National Guard to replace unvaccinated healthcare workers. Now, one part of this, which I'm going to talk about in the next segment, is whether a lot of these people are lying about quitting, whether these are empty threats. I believe that they mostly are, and I'm going to give you data to support that in the next segment. But the question here is, for the people who really are going to refuse, is it just time to start firing them? As we talked about yesterday on the bonus show, the state of New York is the first test case of what actually enforcing a government-issued mandate looks like. Monday is the deadline for healthcare workers in New York to get the jab or get the pink slip. As the New York Times reports, resistance to vaccine mandates has so far stopped most states from threatening to fire unvaccinated workers, but New York's newly appointed governor is calling the unvaccinated's bluff. Rather than caving in and letting them keep their jobs, she is prepared to call the National Guard to fill in the shortages left by the upcoming firings. What I believe needs to happen here is that we should allow these folks to quit if they really are willing to quit, and most are not. And it should be seriously considered by employers whether to just fire people rather than to require the testing. You know, half of unvaccinated workers in some polls have said they'd rather quit than get the vaccine. The real world data doesn't suggest that that's actually the case, and that most of these folks are not actually going to quit. Now, one important question would be, if the mandates didn't work, would they make sense? Because at the end of the day, what I care about is actually getting people vaccinated. The article goes on to say, the effectiveness of mandates has been documented outside of New York as well. As Dr. Zeke Emanuel, former White House policy advisor who works for UPenn now, told Fierce Healthcare, healthcare systems that have actually mandated this have retained over 99% of their workforce. That number we find elsewhere as well. The article goes on to list over a dozen hospital systems that have implemented vaccine mandates. In every case, the fraction of workers lost was tiny, certainly well worth losing to protect patients and the larger community from COVID. Similar success at United Airlines, started putting workers on leave if they don't get vaccinated. 97% of employees beat the deadline. And then the sort of conclusion here is, this is precisely why vaccine mandates are so important. The absolute risk of losing a job is going to motivate a lot more people than the abstract risk of dying of COVID. But for the threat to become real, it has to be real. And this means it's not enough to threaten to fire people who won't get vaccinated. Employers and governments have to follow through. Hochul is right to do whatever it takes to make sure that the unvaccinated get their pink slips this week. If leaders back down in the face of vaccine resistance, the Trumpers will double down and continue spreading COVID in a pathetic effort to own the liberals. Threats cannot be empty, especially when facing stubborn people who believe themselves impervious to consequences. Threats need to be backed up with action. It's time to start firing the unvaccinated. I completely agree with this. And you, if you want to make the case that a business shouldn't even issue the threat, or that these should not be the battle lines on this issue, well, you can have that debate. You could say, actually, I think it's counterproductive to mandate the vaccine. The data says actually the vaccine mandates work very well. It's 97 to 99% when companies put it in place. Most people aren't actually going to quit their job. But once you've gone to doing it, the threat can't be an empty threat, because otherwise it's not going to be effective. And much like, I mean, you know, this is kind of like the strict father morality that the right often preaches, which we on the left often say, you know, we want to make sure it's well calibrated. It can't be an empty threat. And what we are finding is that even among those threatening to quit about the vaccine, very, very few actually are. Let's talk about that next. So we talked about, should unvaccinated workers be fired? And my position there is, if the company has announced you must be vaccinated or you can't work here, they cannot be empty threats. That if you're saying you're going to fire people if they're not vaccinated, you've absolutely got to do it. Okay. So the next question is, when people, when workers say, I'll quit, do they actually do it? And increasingly, the evidence is they do not. Let's look at a couple articles from Massachusetts related to Massachusetts State Police. There are reportedly just under 2,200 state troopers right now. Okay. Let's call it 2,200. It's actually 2,187. Dozens of Massachusetts State Police troopers have been resigning, claim that they are resigning over the COVID vaccine mandate, union says. This is an article from yesterday. And this article says the State Police Association of Massachusetts says dozens of troopers have submitted their resignation papers as a result of the mandate. The state is requiring all executive department employees to show proof of vaccination by the 17th or risk losing their jobs. About 20% of state police employees are not vaccinated, according to the union's attorney. A source told WBZ-TV on Monday, only one state trooper has told human resources they would resign because of the vaccine mandate. They also said there are others who spoke with HR to evaluate what their pensions would be if they chose to retire. The union released this statement. To date, dozens of troopers have submitted resignation paperwork, some of whom plan to return to other departments offering alternatives such as mask wearing and regular testing. The state police are already critically short-staffed and acknowledged this by the unprecedented moves, which took troopers from specialty units that investigate homicides. So you've got a story which is the union says dozens have submitted resignation paperwork, but then only one person has actually said, I'm resigning to human resources. Another article from the Boston Globe. State police union says dozens of troopers plan to resign due to vaccine mandate, but police spokesman says only one definitively has. So we have to wonder, is what's going on with the union claiming dozens have submitted resignation, does that actually translate to people are actually really going to quit? So far, it's one out of 2,187 Massachusetts state troopers that have actually communicated this to human resources. I'm not saying that the union is lying, but I'm wondering whether they've collected resignation letters that many don't actually intend to give to anybody in human resources as part of a political statement of sorts. These are good jobs. You know, there's the waiting list to become a Massachusetts state trooper is very, very long. And these are really good jobs. Are they really going to quit over a vaccine requirement in particular when their pensions may be at risk? The real headline so far seems to be fewer than, what is it, 0.1% of troopers have actually resisted the vaccination requirement. It's very easy to talk about quitting a well-paying job with great health care and retirement benefits over a safe vaccine, but it's a very different thing to actually go and to do it. So my question is, are a lot of these people just bluffing and they're not really going to quit? It is great to welcome to the program today Heidi Boghossian, who's a New York City-based attorney and author whose latest book is I Have Nothing to Hide and 20 Other Myths About Surveillance and Privacy. It's really great having you on. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, David. Great to be here.
So let's start historically a little bit if we can. Was there sort of a surveillance state before 9/11 and the Patriot Act and the bulk surveillance that we've learned about over the last decade or so? What was there an apparatus that predated that, and to what extent?
There has always been a surveillance apparatus in the United States, and the justification for it remains the same. It's largely based on the government's theory that we need to be monitored to protect national security. And I think what we've seen with the events of 9/11, but also as the digital age has really taken over our lives, we've seen that surveillance apparatus on steroids in effect, and the ways that we can be monitored are just about as many as one can imagine. And we're seeing so many levels of creativity to do that, from spying on children to just invading all aspects of our daily lives.
Let's talk about some of the methods, I guess, because people may not be familiar with all of them. I think metadata is a term that many more people now are familiar with maybe than they used to be, in this concept of, well, even without the content of a phone call, a list of the numbers you've interacted with can be very revealing and invasive when it comes to observing your activities. But can you talk a little bit about the breadth of these techniques and technologies that are in place?
An easy way to look at the extent to which we are monitored is to think of the gold rush of the early days of this nation. We're in a data rush right now, and data represents essentially the crude oil that fuels our digital economy. So every time you log on, we have third party, we have data aggregators, which is more than a $200 million, billion-dollar business in this country. So if you think of it as your personal information is like nuggets of gold that others want to reap, collect as much as they can, essentially, without the laws, sort of like the property laws that didn't exist when we had the early gold rush, our legislators have not kept up with tech advances. So that Facebook, for example, just announced that it was putting the pause on developing an app, an Instagram-type app for kids.
Right.
Which really habituates not only young kids to become loyal users of that app, but it allows third parties to gather personal information. It may be just what sites they visit, what preferences they have when they purchase something online or when they ask their parents to buy something. Each of those kernels, when put together, can give a really accurate profile of our lives. And you mentioned metadata. Well, metadata is defined very loosely as information about information. So it's sort of when a photo might have been taken, it's kind of embedded in all of the documents that we get online. That, when captured in large quantities and having algorithms applied to search for patterns in that, can really tell a lot about who we are. For example, if I went to a cancer doctor 5 times in 1 week, or an abortion provider, that information is then sold to others, including government agencies, but largely marketers and for-profit entities who then design ads to target us to buy more of a similar product or to send us ads about cancer treatments and medications. The problem is, when you get faulty algorithms, as we so often do, and one example was drone strikes that this country launched in Afghanistan and other countries from 2006 on, there were flawed algorithms, which means that in that case, there were lethal consequences. People who really shouldn't have been on a terrorist watch list, for example, may have been killed in drone strikes, innocent individuals.
Right. There's kind of two layers on which we could talk about the security aspect of the surveillance state. One would be, does it make us, quote, safer? And if it did, we could then have a debate about the trade-offs and whether that's worthwhile. So maybe we can start with the first piece. Do we know that these techniques put in place starting around 9/11 and going forward, does this increase safety in any measurable way?
There's been no evidence to prove that it does increase safety. And that's really a tragedy, because I think millions of Americans may think they're doing the right thing by saying, I have nothing to hide, you can have my data. But I think it was the Navy War College issued a report years ago saying that they had analyzed so-called threats of terrorists and found that the measures put in place after 9/11, which really cut back on a lot of our liberties and certain constitutional rights that we take for granted, they found no evidence that it made us safer in any instance. And I think the problem is most people don't know that. It's not publicized because in addition to bolstering the claim that it does make us safer, what it ultimately does is hand over information that gives more control to those in charge. And that means less autonomy in our personal lives and more control by others.
Now, if it, let's talk about I Have Nothing to Hide maybe a little bit. A few years ago, I mean, that seemed pretty reasonable to me. You know, my feeling was, yeah, I get that there may be people who know more about me than I would willingly give up. But I don't have any particular reason to worry about this because I don't have anything to hide. And then I read about overcriminalization, about how sometimes you may not think you have anything to hide, but you may inadvertently have done something or interacted with someone who does maybe have something to hide. And then all of the other pernicious ways in which this can be used. What's the best sort of argument against that idea of, I really don't care, I don't have anything to hide?
I think a fundamental argument against that is that people need to realize the importance that privacy has played in this society. For example, during the AIDS epidemic, a lot of healthcare providers, hotlines, realized that in order to help quell the spread of HIV, they would need to offer anonymous reporting or anonymous testing. And that's true in so many other segments. So, for example, a woman who has been the victim of spousal abuse has to know if she's going to come forward to seek help that she can do so anonymously or privately. And there are different levels of how you shield one's identity. But that pertains to whistleblowing in government, to encourage people to come forward when they see malfeasance in the institutions in which we put our trust. So I think you have to first start at privacy plays an essential part in society. And then you have to realize that if you're willing to hand over your entire life to the government, we do so because we trust the government. And I think, you know, that's a wonderful premise on which to base a democracy. But we have seen, in fact, that we cannot always trust our leaders, that self-interest or other factors may lead them to abuse our information, or very often just due to a casual mistake. My name may be confused with a similar name. I may be mixed up with someone who did commit a crime, for example, but because of the databases that all of our information is stored in contain so many errors, often just sloppy data entries, that there have been so many cases of people caught up in a crime that had nothing to do with their lives and they were falsely prosecuted. It also shows that if the government doesn't like what you say, if you're a dissident or just an outspoken individual who criticizes a corporate policy, for example, or a government policy, they can target you and find just about any reason among the many antiquated laws that are on our books to go after you.
Yeah, that I'm almost done reading this new book, The Perfect Police State, about China and the persecution of the Uyghur population. Is there a spectrum in the sense of it seems in terms of surveillance, China is very much on one end. What's on the other end and where on that spectrum is the United States in your assessment?
That's an excellent question. We do look to China as an example of the extreme and what we as a purported democracy would never want to be, where, for example, I just have to say they have a system that is being used in some parts of China where you're under such constant surveillance that if you jaywalk, for example, or if you don't pick up after your dog, points are deducted.
Yes.
And that can, you know, reflect the electricity you get, the access to social services. On the other extreme, and that's a great question because I can't really think of a nation. So many of our partners in the so-called Five Eyes, New Zealand, Canada, the UK, have sort of rings of surveillance everywhere. It's become the norm and we're becoming conditioned to just accept that. But I would imagine there are probably countries in Scandinavia or countries maybe in South America where the technology in some of those countries may not be as sophisticated as what we have here with our robust economy. So I would imagine that in countries without that kind of surveillance accessibility, you don't have the digital surveillance we have here.
And so where is the U.S. on this spectrum right now in your assessment?
I think the U.S. is pretty high up there with England, for example, as basically having the equivalent of these, what we call rings of steel, the circles of surveillance cameras, closed circuit TV. But we have it built into our economy so that as simple as getting a cup of coffee may have a loyalty card where they track the numbers of coffees that you buy, but they also track more, your credit card number, which is linked to other data. I think that the U.S. is in a race to perfect total information awareness, the collection, and with the entry of 5G, where more things will be even connected. And when they're internet connected, that provides near perfect access to our data.
I wonder, let me see how I can kind of frame this up. I wonder if there's a degree of inevitability to this because of the direction, not from a law enforcement standpoint, but from a sociocultural technology standpoint, if there's a degree of inevitability to some of this. And I'll give you like one example and then we can talk about it. The entire literature now around longevity and living longer, healthier lives and nanomedicine and customized it's mostly all premised on having much more data, not only about you as an individual, but data about how you compare to others and what sort of diet or supplements or treatments or whatever the case may be good for you specifically. There's really no way, it seems, to do this stuff without many more parties having access not only to our individual data, but to everybody's in some sense. And for the most part, I mean, in some kind of like general sense, a lot of that stuff sounds kind of interesting. Like it would be great to know what exact diet or what exact preventive treatment. So is there some inevitability to this that is going to be hard to restrict at all?
I think that's absolutely right. First, we have convenience. Then we have the kind of addictive quality that these devices have, and they're created in effect, just like video games, to be addictive.
Yeah.
But there are, as with all technology, so many positive benefits, as you mentioned. And I think the trick is harnessing those, but also having an educated public that is able to realize when they should have the option of saying, I don't wish to share that. And I think the problem that we're having and why I wrote this book sort of is a primer so people can get a sense of the different areas that we're impacted by is we need to first, our legislators have to be more educated about technology. They're woefully behind the advancements. And that's a problem because they can't craft laws that keep a pace with new technologies that are emerging daily,
right,
and new applications. So I think if we have a program where we educate kids the first time they learn to type on a keyboard, what the perils are and what the benefits are, and really develop a healthy course in school that parents also participate in digital hygiene. We would not, for example, let a stranger walk into our bedroom every night and use our toothbrush or just make themselves at home downstairs. And that's in effect what we're doing and what young kids are doing without that education. So I think you have to educate the public and our leaders to the degree that they are able to say, we need to build in privacy, for example, into our devices, or the software has to be better tested before it's put on the marketplace to ensure that adequate privacy protections are built into their infrastructure.
Last thing I want to touch on with you, if someone right now makes it a priority to prevent themselves from being tracked, watched, monitored, surveilled, etc., you Google this and you see things like turn off microphone access for your Facebook app on your phone, right? Very, very narrow and specific thing, all the way to don't use banks or credit cards, which for the average participant in the modern economy is not at all sort of practical. To what degree is it possible to really not be tracked right now, regardless of how aggressively you're willing to adopt these things, or to some degree, if you're sort of like living on the grid, it's quite difficult at this point in time.
It's super difficult. One would have to literally not use a credit card, stay off online searches.
Yeah.
And I think what's daunting to most people, and I get it, is that, you know, encrypting, for those who are reporters or journalists who have to protect confidential sources, there are wonderful measures in place that they can use. It becomes more difficult for the average citizen to use all of those, but there are basic things like not using the same password over, changing it, using a sentence instead of your pet's name. There are basic things that aren't that hard, enabling two-factor authentication, for example, when you log into accounts. Keep down the number of apps that you have. They're really portals, unless they come directly from the manufacturer. Don't download things from online. There are measures you can take to reduce the amount of surveillance. I think it's unrealistic to say you can stop it entirely unless you go off the grid.
Yeah, yeah. The book is I Have Nothing to Hide and 20 Other Myths About Surveillance and Privacy. We've been speaking with the book's author, New York City-based attorney Heidi Boghossian. Such a pleasure having you on. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, David.
All right, I have some extraordinarily disturbing video to play for you. This is a new interview with, again, I guess, former Trump fraud lawyer Sidney Powell. You might remember that whether she was even Trump's lawyer is like a subject of debate. She was having meetings in the Oval Office, which certainly signals a connection to Donald Trump. At the same time, the Trump campaign at one point put out a statement when she went really bonkers, saying she's working on her own. We still don't really have answers to that, but she's delivered some very strange interviews recently. Sidney Powell has now given an interview in which she drags Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito into the January 6th mess. The claim that she makes is that part of the point of the January 6th riots was to delay things enough that Samuel Alito would be able to intervene and somehow give the election to Trump. I mean, you know how these things are. It's always like, well, exactly how, it's not clear. She gave an interview on the Stu Peters show. This is not a program I'm familiar with, but her claim, if she's right, this is the most extreme premeditated criminality, including the highest levels of power that maybe we've ever seen. If she's making it up, she probably needs a psych eval. I mean, I don't, you know, to be totally honest, I don't really know which of the two it is. But let's take a look at this. Here is the interview. Let's listen to Sidney Powell. The audio quality is terrible. The video quality is terrible. But let's do our best to try to really understand what it is she's claiming here.
Heard untold election case.
Yes, we were filing a 12th Amendment constitutional challenge to the process that the Congress was about to use under the Electoral Act provisions that simply don't jive with the 12th Amendment to the United States Constitution. And Justice Alito was our circuit justice for that. Louis Gohmert was the plaintiff in our lawsuit. And we were suing the vice president to follow the 12th Amendment as opposed to the Electoral Count Act, or Electoral College Act. So that was the main point. And Nancy Pelosi had finagled to file an amicus brief in it. There'd been inside goings on in Congress whereby I believe it was Steve Scalise and McCarthy kept her from being an actual party. She wanted to work her way into the case as a party, but somehow politically that didn't happen. But so she got noticed when we made her filing because she wanted to file an amicus brief or had filed an amicus brief. And then
now, if you're confused, the guy on the left looks as confused as you and I probably are. I'll try to explain what she's talking about in a second. Although, again, if these are just her delusions, there is no explanation.
You know, everything broke loose and she had to really speed up reconvening Congress to get the vote going before Justice Alito might have issued an injunction to stop it all, which is what should have happened.
Okay. So the gist of what she seems to be saying here is that the idea of the riot was to create a delay so that you could get a particular amicus, or as she says, amicus brief to the Supreme Court with the idea that Samuel Alito, again, I'm trying to interpret what a crazy person is saying, but the idea is Samuel Alito would be able to do something and then Trump becomes president, I guess, or something like that. But they didn't anticipate that Nancy Pelosi would so quickly reconvene on January 6th, late, really early January 7th. It was kind of the middle of the night, you know, technically January 7th for much of it, and move forward, and that's what interfered with this. Now, if this is true, and Alito knew that this was the expectation, or, you know, said okay, I mean, it would be an incredible conspiracy at the absolute highest level. It would have all been premeditated, if Powell is to be believed. Samuel Alito should be impeached. Okay. It also might just be completely made up. And I'm going to be very honest with you. It almost seems more likely to me. I mean, Sidney Powell lies all the time. And she might be making all of this up, and that's its own problem. And that would be one possibility. Now, the third possibility is she believes this stuff, but it's not true. Like, she's actually delusional. And if that's the case, you're really talking psych eval. I mean, I'm going to be totally frank. That's what it is. So if what she says is true, it would be grounds for impeaching Samuel Alito, potentially. If it's a lie, then she's really a crazy liar who's willing to just make up anything. And if she believes it, but it's completely imaginary, it's kind of a sad mental health sort of situation. Let's go to one more clip. This is funny because this is now the interviewer, and I'm trying to figure out, like, what is he's trying to explain what Sidney Powell, I guess, said, and it's like it's even more confusing. Let's listen.
Up the coup, why Nancy Pelosi had to hurry on January 6th. According to Powell, on the very day of January 6th, there was a one last-ditch legal effort that might have stopped the certification of disputed electoral states by the Congress, a legal challenge to the Electoral Count Act, a 130-year-old law that governs the actual Electoral College process. Now, this law gives both the House and Senate explicit roles in evaluating electoral slates, even though the 12th Amendment to the Constitution only gives the House a role in choosing the president.
Okay. So this is a part of what they've been pushing, which is we need to only the House should be picking the president. Like, the Senate shouldn't even have been involved on January 6th. This is another one of these. It's sort of like if I misspell my name, I'm not taxable. Like, that was a whole movement at one. It's that type of movement. And Stu Peters seems to be sort of explaining that.
The Senate, as we know, is only involved in choosing a vice president.
Right.
So Powell brought a lawsuit to overturn that law, but only filed it the afternoon of January 6th while a bunch of people were trampling.
Would have been something to think about sooner, right?
Through the Capitol in what later would be referred to as the Great Insurrection.
Yeah.
Now, that insurrection might have played to her advantage by delaying the final resolution of the election, but then Nancy Pelosi one-upped her by reconvening Congress and finishing the tally in the middle of the night. The next day, Supreme Court Justice Alito dismissed the case. But according to Powell, it might have been different if that election wasn't already over.
So I guess he's just explaining. If I'm understanding him correctly, my understanding of what Sidney Powell is claiming is accurate. It doesn't make what Sidney Powell is claiming any more true. So who knows what the truth is? Maybe Powell increasingly thinks she's going down, and she's seeing who can I take down with me. If I implicate Alito, maybe it helps me in some way. The bigger picture is the more we learn, the more premeditated this might have been on January 6th, allegedly involving more and more parties. Whether any individual claim is true, honestly, I don't know, because the people involved are so dishonest. Rudy, Jenna Ellis, Sidney Powell, Trump himself, Bannon. You know, if these people had their way, the U.S. would be a complete and total theocracy, an authoritarian Christian theocracy. That's actually what we're fighting against here. I want to address a series of articles that people sent me, each in its own way, sort of saying Trump could really be going down for some crimes here. Okay? Now, I'm going to give you my conclusion up front. The most likely scenario is this stuff doesn't happen. But there have been enough articles and enough people wrote to me that I want to tell you what's being said. And you've got to look at the language. A Business Insider article. Donald Trump could be charged with multiple crimes over his attempts to overturn his loss in Georgia, a report says. The article saying the report by the Brookings Institution, a think tank in Washington, D.C., analyzed publicly available evidence that showed Trump and his allies attempted to pressure Georgia officials to change the lawful outcome of the election. A key piece of evidence is the now infamous Trump call where he wanted to find 11,780 votes. There's no way I lost Georgia. There's no way we won by hundreds of thousands of votes. Those assertions were, of course, false. And the report added that Trump publicly pressured and contacted Republican officials to ask for their help. We conclude that Trump's post-election conduct in Georgia leaves him at substantial risk of possible state charges predicated on multiple crimes. These charges potentially include criminal solicitation to commit fraud, election fraud, intentional interference with performance of election duties, conspiracy to commit election fraud, criminal solicitation, and state RICO violations. The report adds liability could extend to allies like Rudy Giuliani. Another article from Vanity Fair says, report, Trump may be hit with multiple criminal charges over his effort to overturn the election in Georgia. This is by Bess Levin, who's done a lot of great coverage over the years. It references the exact same report from the Brookings Institution, and it mentions the request to find 11,780 votes. It refers to Trump pressure that happened publicly and privately against Republican officials. And it again says Trump could be hit with that same list of charges based on the same Brookings Institution report. And then lastly, from the Detroit News, Trump faces substantial legal risk in Georgia case, think tank report says. This is from that same Brookings Institution report, and it lists the exact same stuff. So basic media literacy. First things first, all of these articles are really one story. The Brookings Institution's opinion is Trump could face substantial legal problems. What needs to be clarified is if he were a normal person. I continue to see no appetite in charging Trump for what he did in Georgia. Should he be charged? Yeah. Yeah. Could he be charged? Absolutely. The ongoing question is less about could or should it happen, but will it happen? Now, you can look at Georgia and you can say, well, on the one hand, Republicans control basically everything in Georgia. They don't control the Senate seats, but that is not involved. Whoa, as I hit my mic, sorry. That is not involved here. We're talking about state charges here. And Republicans in Georgia aren't going to hold Donald Trump accountable for anything. He operates with impunity. It's infuriating, but it's just not going to happen. The other side of it is that, you know, the truth is these elected officials in Georgia don't actually have anything to do with what is happening. It's really the Fulton County DA, and the Fulton County DA has experience with organized crime and may not be beholden to the political interests of state Republicans in Georgia. I don't know the answer. My continued belief is Trump's not going down. Allies might, other people might. I don't see Trump going down. If you disagree with me, let me know. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Here is Eric from Massachusetts. We're getting away from the Eric from Mass stuff very soon, don't worry. But he's calling back again with more. I don't even know what he's talking about. Listen to this.
Hey, David, it's Eric from Mass. Hey, I went to the doctor today and got, you won't understand any of this, but it's called a Titer's test, T-I-T-E-R-S. And it looks like I do have natural immunity. So explain to me now why I need a vaccine when I have natural immunity that does exist. I'm willing to go on your show, show you the paperwork, and then have you tell me why I need a vaccine when I'm already immune. I mean, what? I thought you cared about people. That was what I thought originally.
I'm doing my best not to jump in.
That's why I originally called. You seem like a guy on the level and all this, just a little misinformed. You don't give a fuck about anybody, dude. You just give about the, you care about the money again from the vaccine. And Alex Jones had a list, and you were on it. One of the mid to top. I think they were giving up to $50,000. I mean, who the fuck do you think you're fooling, dude?
All right. So listen, there is no evidence anybody has paid me to promote vaccines. I don't even know why anyone would need to pay me. I just look at data and I don't promote. I just report what's out there. We've dealt with this before. Natural immunity is not as strong as vaccinated immunity. And the strongest possible immunity is vaccinated plus recovered from COVID. That's the strongest. So the continued, you know, this is one voicemail. There are dozens of people who leave me voicemails like this and who send me emails with the same type of idea. This is its own virus that is spreading. It's sad more than anything. But fortunately, you know, Eric from Mass is in a state of mostly vaccinated people, and that's a good thing for him too, even if he refuses to get the vaccine. Joe Manchin might single-handedly upend the child tax credit. We're going to talk about it on today's bonus show. There is a Pfizer pill in testing to prevent COVID-19. We will talk about that. And John Hinckley, who shot President Reagan, has won unconditional release. We will talk about the details and the backstory and the decision that's been made, all on today's bonus show. Get instant access.
I'm John McCain, and I'm from Arizona. But when I'm in Pittsburgh, I always listen to WRCT, one of the finest stations in all of radio. And Carnegie Mellon University is one of the finest academic institutions in our country. Be sure at your next election to vote early and vote often.
Again, I had the dream. I tossed and I turned. That old feeling still the same. It was so real. I woke up cold and sweating. I wonder, did I call her name? In the dream, she was right there with me. Right there with me in the bed. She said, Bobby, come and kiss me. But when I reached out to hold her, oh, I woke my wife instead. Thank you.
Since I've seen her, ain't no doubt about what it means. I tried hard not to think about her, but all she left me was a scream. All she a dream.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Hold the line, Speaker Pelosi! Will you hold the line?
Will you hold the line?
House progressives and activists are calling on Speaker Nancy Pelosi to hold the line and bring both the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill and the $3.5 trillion Build Back Better Act together to the floor. We'll look at what's in the bills with David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect, who's working with The Intercept and The Daily Poster to keep a running count of where progressive votes stand. And we'll speak with the Reverend Dr. William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign, asking for a meeting with the White House to put a face on the urgent needs of this moment.
It's about understanding that the reason we have to do it is because we haven't done it before and invested properly. We put $21 trillion into war since 9/11. And now some want to block a compromise plan of just over $3 trillion over 10 years. No. No. The cost is too high.
Then to Germany, where the center-left Social Democratic Party declared victory in Sunday's election, putting an end to the 16-year era of Angela Merkel's conservative leadership. We'll look at what this means for Europe and the world with Yanis Varoufakis, the former finance minister of Greece, who negotiated with Merkel and international creditors in 2015 when they demanded harsh new austerity measures for a European bailout of Greece, largely at Merkel's behest.
Our government won the election in January 2015 with a mandate to speak truth to the powerful, to say no to them, and do your worst. We're not accepting any more of your toxic loans under conditions that will shrink our economy and our people further.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, House progressives say they'll hold the line and oppose the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill Thursday after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she would seek a vote Thursday on the measure without a commitment to also pass the Build Back Better Act, the $3.5 trillion 10-year bill that expands the social safety net and combats climate change. Activists from People's Watch and Sunrise Movement are demonstrating in D.C. D.C. this week to pressure Pelosi and Democrats to pass the measure through reconciliation. Activists confronted Pelosi Tuesday evening as she headed into a fundraiser.
Nancy Pelosi, will you hold the line on the reconciliation bill for climate justice for California? Will you hold the line?
Meanwhile, President Biden met Tuesday with conservative Democratic senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, who received major donations from financial institutions, fossil fuel companies, and other industries who oppose the spending package. In Italy, climate activists spoke at the Youth for Climate Conference in Milan. This is Ugandan activist Vanessa Nakate.
Historically, Africa is responsible for only 3% of global emissions. And yet Africans are already suffering some of the most brutal impacts fueled by the climate crisis. Rapidly intensifying hurricanes, devastating floods, and withering droughts. Many Africans are losing their lives, while countless more have lost their livelihoods.
Greta Thunberg addressed the inaction by world leaders in her address.
This is not about some expensive, politically correct green act of bunny hugging or blah, blah, blah. Build back better, blah, blah, blah. Green economy, blah, blah, blah. Net zero by 2050, blah, blah, blah. Net zero by 2050, blah, blah, blah. Net zero, blah, blah, blah. Climate neutral, blah, blah, blah. This is all we hear from our so-called leaders. Words. Words that sound great,